from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, a new study from an Australian-based human rights group reports that nearly 30 million people worldwide are living in slavery-like conditions, with almost half of them in India. The study is the first ever global index on slavery and it tracks forced labor, human trafficking, and the sale of children, among other abuses, and we'll discuss modern-day slavery worldwide and what forms of slavery and human trafficking exist here in the Bay Area. That's coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The first ever Global Slavery Index was released on Thursday by the Australian Walk Free Foundation, finding that some 30 million people globally, 16 million of them in India, are presently living in slavery-like conditions, including human trafficking, debt bondage, forced or servile marriage, and the exploitation of children. That includes their use in armed conflicts. This morning's opening forum hour, we discuss human slavery. We have a panel, but first we're going to go to Brussels and welcome Nick Grono, who is the CEO of the Walk Free Foundation, which, as I said, recently released the Global Slavery Index. And this is not only the first of its kind, but the first to compare the number of slaves among countries throughout the world. And Nick Grono, good to have you on forum. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, I guess the first thing we should probably do is define slavery. I mean, we're talking about factories, brothels, rice mills and rug looms and such, a wide variety of things that to get a grasp on it globally is perhaps best to understand how it's defined.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the key objectives of this report. We define modern slavery as including things like human trafficking, forced labor, child soldiers, all the things that you've mentioned. And we focus very much on the use of violence or coercion to force people into a situation where they're exploited economically, they receive little or subsistence pay only, and they're not free to leave. I mean, that's the essence of it, that they are controlled and they don't have the ability to leave of their own volition.
And we're talking about, in some cases, victims actually sold, hereditary slavery. I mean, something that everybody thought was vanquished years ago, but here it is going on virtually all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, one of the key findings is that the country that came out worst on our index in the world is Mauritania, a West African country. It has the highest percentage of its population estimated to be in modern slavery, and it is unusual in that it still has a form of hereditary slavery where people are born into slavery.
The Mauritania is about 16% of its population, which is pretty startling in itself. Yeah.
It was a very high number, which is why we put it up at the top of the rankings. After Mauritania, we had Haiti, which has a huge problem with child slavery in particular, and then South Asia comes in. Pakistan, India, and Nepal all have big problems with everything from bonded labor to sex trafficking, forced sexual exploitation, debt bondage. You know, the full range of slavery and slavery-like practices.
Well, and here in the United States, the estimate is it ranks 134th of all these nations, but between 57 and 63,000 in human slavery.
Yeah, so the U.S. does relatively well on the rankings, but, you know, what we're pointing out to everyone is a number of 50 to 60,000, which I'm sure is a conservative number, and I know your other panelists like David Batstone will be able to talk in much more detail to those numbers. That's still an horrific number, and you have people in the U.S. enslaved, you have big issues with migrants that are enslaved in forms of, you know, in agricultural sectors, in a whole range of shapes and forms.
And this is a higher number, for the most part, or the numbers are higher, I should say, than the International Labor Organization, which estimated 21 million people in forced labor.
Yeah, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that I suspect that we've been able to review the data more exhaustively, but also they're focused on one aspect of the modern slavery problem, forced labor, which admittedly covers the bulk of it, but not all of the forced labor, all of the modern slavery problem. And also, you know, the point that we make in our index is that the data out there is pretty weak. I mean, it's a hidden crime. And a lot more work needs to go into getting a better understanding of this. When the ILO did its first survey about 6 years ago or so, it had an estimate of about 12 or 13 million, which it then significantly increased over the years. So we hope that, this index will encourage organisations like the ILO, the UN, the EU and countries themselves to focus much more intensely on this problem and help us produce better data so we get a more accurate read on exactly what the problem is and how it can be addressed.
We're talking to Nick Rono, who's CEO of the Walk Free Foundation. He's with us this morning from Brussels, and they recently released a Global Slavery Index, the first ever of its kind. Actually, you mentioned the UN. There is a UN protocol to punish, suppress, and prevent human trafficking, and there's also hundreds of international treaties that ban slavery and slave trade. I mean, are these essentially ineffectual and not being enforced or have no teeth?
Yeah. Slavery has historically been banned. There's UN 1926 UN treaty. It's illegal everywhere. It's illegal under international law, yet it still exists on this massive scale. And there's lots of reasons for that. One is that until recently, you know, modern slavery hasn't received the attention it deserves. That's slowly changing. Another is that there are vested interests that benefit from it, particularly criminal gangs that massively exploit, the ability to traffic people into slavery. And where there's economic incentives, then people will seek to exploit that. So we hope that this report will help contribute to greater awareness and support the efforts of governments that are prepared to focus on this and all the wonderful non-profits and NGOs that are out there that are working very hard to address the problem to do so much more effectively.
Well, we should also mention that behind drug trafficking, human trafficking is actually tied with arms dealing as the second largest criminal industry in the world, about $32 billion a year. And that this report also points out that the countries with the fewest number of human slaves are in Ireland, Iceland, and the UK, just for the record. But Nick Rono, this report points to the failure of the Indian government. I mean, it's really kind of, in effect, still a caste system or an untouchable system.
Yeah, India comes out. In terms of absolute number of slaves, it has an estimated 14 million or so in slavery. Obviously, that's a reflection of the fact that there's a high percentage of its population in slavery and its massive population size. What we find and what the report kind of documents is that factors like, weak rule of law, discrimination, marginalization of particular groups are all contributing factors to slavery. And, of course, in India, the caste system certainly contributes because it enables segments of the population to be marginalized and discriminated against and hence exploited. And we very much hope that the Indian government, I mean, this is not a particularly new finding. There's been a lot of awareness for a long time that India has a particular problem, but hopefully this report will help generate, renewed efforts by Indian governments and other groups to focus on this problem.
Nick Rono, again with us from Brussels this morning, CEO of the Walk Free Foundation, Australian-based group, which recently released the Global Slavery Index. And thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for your interest. Thank you.
And also joining us this morning here in studio is David Batstone, whom Nick Rono mentioned. He's president of the Not For Sale Campaign, an international agency dedicated to ending global slavery. He's also professor of business at the University of San Francisco and author of Not For Sale, The Return of the Global Slave Trade and How We Can Fight It. Welcome.
Hey, Michael. It's good to be on the show again.
Good to have you back. And we also have Benjamin Skinner with us this morning. He's with us from New York. He's the author of A Crime So Monstrous, Face to Face with Modern Day Slavery. Benjamin Skinner, good to have you. Good morning.
Good to be back.
And we also have Nola Brantley with us, who is executive director and co-founder of Motivating, Inspiring, Supporting, and Serving Sexually Exploited Youth, that is otherwise known as MISSY. They're based in Oakland, and she's with us by phone this morning from Pennsylvania. Good to have you, Nola Brantley.
Good to be on the show, especially with these two amazing gentlemen.
Well, thank you. Let me speak with these two amazing gentlemen. In fact, David Batstone, let's talk to you first. You've been doing a lot of research locally, and maybe we can initially focus on that because people think, oh, the Bay Area, as progressive as it is, he had 70 people who were working as slaves on the Bay Bridge.
Exactly. It was something that my students at the University of San Francisco were shocked to uncover that, here in our own backyard, a bridge that, we like to travel on this morning, it's not so easy to travel on, but that there's other kinds of traffic, and that's the trafficking of people to our own backyard. In fact, Michael, I learned about this whole problem at a restaurant on the East Bay. Hundreds of kids from the Bangalore, India region were brought to the United States for forced labor in this restaurant. then taken out to fruit and vegetable fields, brothels, and construction crews in the Bay Area. So it was a very personal home issue for me here in the Bay Area.
It's hard to prove trafficking, though, especially there are people brought here, they're forced into labor. A lot of it is like massage parlor workers and prostitution and so forth, but very difficult to really find the kind of proof that's necessary because a lot of these people are frightened, they're illegal, and that's the difficulty you face.
Yeah, absolutely. When Nick mentioned that there's 50 to 60,000, I think that is a very conservative number for the very reasons that you say. It's an invisible crime, but it has to be visible in some aspect because of the fact that people are being employed or deployed to work in some kind of public fashion. So it's really creating the mechanisms where we can help law enforcement identify, expose, and then prosecute on the criminal activity going on.
Well, the Oakland police are estimating that about a third of the teen girls who are out there on the streets are forced into prostitution, either through pimps or through their necessity of finding a way to actually make a living or get away from home or that sort of thing. And, I mean, it's difficult when you have the kind of dwindling resources in terms of the police in Oakland and the prosecutorial resources, et cetera. It becomes increasingly more formidable.
You know, and I'm really impressed with the DA's office over in Oakland. What they've tried to do a lot of prosecution, but the difficulty of arriving at a human trafficking crime is so complex that they often will pursue other, say, more easily achievable prosecution goals like kidnapping or extortion or so things that they can prosecute more easily than human trafficking. And, you know, Nola, who works over in Oakland, can share with you that so many of these young girls, their freedom's taken away from them at a young age. And, this is not like they're a choice that they make every day to continue on a path that ends them up on International Avenue in Oakland.
Nola, can I go to you on this? I mean, you know, we're talking about not only Oakland, but girls in Alameda, out in traffic and so forth. I mean, who just really are forced into prostitution.
Absolutely. And I think when we think about forced, we think about chains and we think about bondage. But we're talking about children who, in many, many cases, have been victims of sex trafficking from a very early age, some of them since they were 7 or 8 years old, and who were first trafficked at the hands of maybe their own biological families, very similar to what we see in other nations. We have those same problems occurring here. And we have to remember that domestically, the large majority of children being sex trafficked are already part of our foster care system and have already been removed from their biological families due to abuse and neglect.
Talk a bit, if you could, about the psychological effect of all this. I know there's been certainly many cases of post-traumatic stress, but just trying to get these young girls and boys too, mostly girls, but boys as well, back reintegrated into some kind of social fabric.
Yeah, I think that's two-pronged. I mean, I think, one, there's a psychological impact that makes a huge barrier to them even being able to break free of this form of slavery. The amount of violence and the impact of this violence results in something that we are known as Stockholm Syndrome. And we relate Stockholm Syndrome to other victims, but it's very rare that you hear about it in terms of sex trafficking victims. But many of these young children are suffering from Stockholm Syndrome, and they feel like if they don't stay close to their perpetrator, they will end up dead.
And the real work often begins after the fact, I mean, after they're freed from this bondage.
Absolutely. So once we get to that point, that would be the second prong. It is a very much a long-term treatment. Many of these children already came from horrific histories of abuse and exploitation even before the sex trafficking. And so we're dealing with that on top of what's happening to them through sex trafficking. The average age of entry in the United States is 12, but the average age of identification is about 15. So we're talking about children, for the most part, who have been sex trafficked for several years before we even identify them and begin this regimen of services, which includes everything from finding them a safe, stabilized place to live, to their basic needs, to psychological treatment, building basic life skills, employment, education, the list goes on. But it's definitely a long-term treatment that these children need. It's not a 6-month or 12-month program. It's a program and treatment that they need to receive for years.
And David Besson, a lot of these children are being brought from economically suffering communities and taken into the big city and then exploited. And we're not only talking about prostitution here, we're talking about economic migrants working in the clothes industry, working in the electronics industry, just about everything.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was for that reason, after I discovered human trafficking and slavery here in the Bay Area, that I took a year leave of absence from my job at USF to go around the world and track, you know, from our backyard to the world And so, you know, these criminal rings extend internationally, obviously, to bring people here. And so, you know, really it's a matter of exposing it. But more than that is, I think the big challenge, and even if, you know, today we hear there's 30 million in slavery, it's creating an inventive and new tools, new models that go upstream. You know, I think Noel and I both feel, in some respect, we're at the end of a river pulling bodies out that are drowning and flailing, and we need to do that work. That's compassion work, and it's important. But we really need to go upstream and find out how we attack slavery at its roots.
Well, one of the persons who's been doing that also and has actually infiltrated some of these traffickers is Benjamin Skinner, the author of A Crime So Monstrous, Face to Face with Modern-Day Slavery, and we have him with us on the line from New York. How do these operations work? I mean, some of them are actually pretty big and labyrinthine, aren't they, Benjamin Skinner?
Yeah, some of them. For the purposes of the book, I went all over the world and looked at different levels of trafficking operations. Some of them were three and four people, you know, a transporter, a recruiter, two or three people to harbor at one end. In other cases, they were, as you say, quite labyrinthine. I talked to traffickers in Romanian prisons that had been convicted after working with groups that trafficked upwards of 1,000 or 2,000 in some cases women, first to points east and then to points west and south to places like Dubai. So there's all different manner of scale to this.
How does U.S. slavery compare to, say, slavery in a more global context? I know that a lot of the slavery is concentrated in West Africa and South Africa and South Asia, excuse me. So one would assume just culturally that there are some vast differences, but are there?
You know, I think Nick Grano very well at the opening of your show here put his finger on the definition. I think it's very important to highlight that again. These are people that are forced to work, held through fraud, can't walk away, not paid anything beyond subsistence. And the vast majority of slaves in that condition are held in some form of debt bondage. In South Asia, oftentimes it's what the UN in its deathless prose calls hereditary collateralized debt bondage, which is really a euphemism for a system of fraud and slavery that is passed on from generation to generation based on what was originally oftentimes a minuscule debt. I talked to one fellow who had been enslaved after his grandfather had taken a debt of 60 of the equivalent in rupees of 62 cents. Three slave masters, three generations later, he's still forced to work in a quarry to pay that off.
And what this boils down to, as you suggest, is the inability to walk away. And often violence, of course, or the threat of violence is hanging over the heads of these people. And we're also talking about child marriage and another person exploiting or people exploiting someone, human trafficking types of things. I'm eager to get at what can be done about this. I mean, especially since so much of it is under the radar and virtually invisible.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you ask. As an investigative journalist for 12 years, I focused largely on understanding at the deepest level possible as an outsider exactly what it meant to be a slave, why slavery persisted. Very often it becomes this relationship of dependence. That's what I found over and over again. It's true today as it was in the antebellum South, where, you know, some slaves are strictly held through sheer violence. Others come to some form of accommodation, and when liberation comes, quote unquote, if they're not provided with retraining, a basket of resources, you get what happened in the American South, where for 80 years after the Civil War, there was the re-enslavement of Southern blacks through a new form of debt bondage. I feel fundamentally, and the report touches on this in various country narratives, the most important factor today is getting corporations involved. Corporations are some of the largest economic entities in the world today. They have power, they have might, And so in my current role, we're actually going in and buying into certain corporations that are infected with things like human trafficking, including human trafficking, and turning them around and making them clean and making them agents of freedom and development for these communities.
Are you willing to name names here?
Sure. You know, I think if you look at the work that I've done recently in terms of investigating corporate supply chains, there were a couple of corporations that are quite big, are quite good reputationally, and the stories are still available online at businessweek.com. That were selling, for example, fish that was caught with slaves. Off the coast of New Zealand, of all places, that were selling products that have palm oil in it, palm oil that we trace back to plantations that use slave labor in Indonesia. What should be a very disconcerting fact is that slavery touches all of our lives. It's not just the deviants that are going out and paying for sex with children. It's those of us that have investments in companies, that purchase products from companies that don't comprehensively understand what's in their supply chains. Californians actually have a good opportunity to find out more as a result of the California Transparency and Supply Chains Act, which requires that any companies that make over $100 million publicly disclose what they're doing to monitor and combat slavery in their supply chains on their corporate websites.
Yeah, but you have to worry about government corruption here, too, in terms of the global picture. I'm just wondering also, since I read your piece that appeared back in the Huffington Post a number of years ago saying slavery is no relic, you singled out then-Senator Barack Obama and said... he, as president, surprisingly, he was doing very little. Is that still the case?
He's doing a lot more. I have to say that was very early on in his tenure, and obviously, in that first year, he was largely focused on healthcare. At the moment, first of all, he's put in place, and somebody's been in place as the trafficking ambassador, the special ambassador, special advisor to the president on human trafficking, somebody by the name of Lou DeBaca, who is responsible for reporting on slavery all over the world, in a report similar to the Global Index. This guy's a serious guy. He's put away more traffickers than any federal prosecutor in American history prior to being an ambassador and the hub of activity on federal activity on this. Beyond that, the president put in place an executive order a year ago that is comprehensively establishes guidelines to root out slavery from government contractors, which was a big problem during the Gulf War, the second Gulf War. But fundamentally, we're not doing enough. Stepping back, looking at this from a question of national priorities, the amount of money that the U.S. government spends to fight trafficking on an annual basis is about what we spend in a single hour to fight the war on drugs.
Let me keep it there for a moment because we're coming up on a break here and I have to give out the phone number. In fact, I welcome those of you listening to join this conversation, and you may have questions or comments, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, so please feel free to join us. The number, 866-733-6786. Again, join us toll-free from wherever or however you're listening to us. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. Talking about nearly 30 million people worldwide living in slavery. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. There's a new study by the Australian-based human rights group, the Walk Free Foundation, that reports that nearly 30 million people worldwide are living in slavery-like conditions, almost half of them in India, and that study is the first ever global index on slavery. It tracks forced labor and human trafficking and the sale of children, among other abuses. And we're discussing modern-day slavery worldwide and what forms of slavery and human trafficking exist here in the Bay Area and throughout the United States. It may seem hard to believe in this day and age, but it's the numbers are convincing and the research is convincing, and there's a lot, as I've been saying, that is really under the radar and invisible. We talk with Nick Rono, the CEO of the Walk Free Foundation, and with us in studio is David Batstone, president of the Not For Sale campaign and author of The Return of the Global Slave Trade and How We Can Fight It. Benjamin Skinner is with us by phone this morning, author of A Crime So Monstrous, Face to Face with Modern Day Slavery, and Nola Brantley, also with us by phone, executive director and co-founder of MISSI, Motivating, Inspiring, Supporting, and Serving Sexually Exploited Youth. We do welcome your involvement in the program, and if you have something you'd like to say or talk to or address, you can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786. I'm certain, in fact, that listeners may indeed have some examples to share with us and some thoughts about what to do about this problem. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum. David Batstone, there are things, of course, that can be done. One of them that people should know about is an app that's available, and this app can tell you, well, let us know specifically what it can tell you.
Yeah. Well, it's created by Not For Sale, my organization, and the app is called Free to Work, free, the number two, and work. And what it allows you to do is see consumer brands, and it grades them A, B, C, D, F, like you get a grade in school, on their mitigation or their lack of mitigation of the supply chain abuses. So, you know, if let's go to chocolate, you find out why does Hershey's, Kit Kat, and Mars, why do they get a D out of, that's not a grade you want your child to get in school.
This is appropriate because I have a question here from a listener who says, on a practical note, you have any suggestions for slave-free Halloween candy? And right to the point with chocolate.
Exactly. Yeah. Divine Chocolate, Sweet Earth Chocolate gets an A. Our own Bay Area Ghirardelli Chocolate gets a C. So, this app, you can go and scan the barcode on a product in your store where you shop, and you can shop appropriately. I don't think any of us really want to wear people's suffering or consume their tragedy with our sweets and chocolates. So it really is about taking effective action on a consumer level as well as on a corporate investment level.
And what about in terms of governmental action? Again, Benjamin Skinner, I can't help avoiding that because there's so much rife corruption in many of these places that have come out high on the index.
Yeah, I think the early on, Kevin Bales, the researcher who assembled much of the index, had pointed out that there's an almost direct correlation between countries with a high prevalence of corruption as measured by Transparency International and those countries that have a high incidence of slavery. Fundamentally, corruption is the facilitator. It's the grower. I too often in places like South Africa, when I was going into human trafficking networks that were arising around the construction of the World Cup stadiums before the last World Cup, I would find that many of the victims were servicing their clients were police. What options does that leave them in terms of a pathway to freedom, a pathway to safety?
And if I could just go back, Nola Brantley, to you, there are kids literally being grabbed off the streets. It's horrifying, but the realization is that that's indeed happening. We had a program, in fact, with some kids from Youth Radio, some young people from Youth Radio, who did a whole study of this and did really good journalism on it. But you've also got these pimps and these would-be Romeos, and you've got the Internet now, too, playing a significant role.
Yeah, the Internet plays a huge role. And I think one of the things that is, unique about the Internet is that some of these same children who are in the foster care system or who don't have parents that are taking care of them, they're at the same risk level as kids on the Internet. Those same perpetrators who are in cyberspace are also the same perpetrators that kids can run into on the street. So what it really does is it puts all children in our country at a huge risk. All children in our country who have access to the Internet and who can get online are at a huge risk for being victimized through this form of abuse, which is different than before. You may have just the risk factor concentrated on the children that have a certain set of risk factors and vulnerabilities, but with the introduction of technology and the Internet, it puts all children at risk.
Looking at a Facebook comment here from a listener named Steve, who says, my wife and her friend in 1999 traveled up the Niger River in Mali on the way to Timbuktu and sat next to a couple traveling with their neighbor's slave. It seemed to be no secret. Some questions about the girl were answered, but unfortunately, the conversation ended when her friend, who is black, insisted on ignoring them and expected the same from my wife. The fact is, it is not taboo to this region, surprised me. And the fact is, well, Benjamin Skinner, slavery in rural areas of Africa is almost acceptable, isn't it?
Yeah, in Mali has a situation of racinated, race-based slavery that is not unlike the situation in Mauritania that Nick Grano was talking about. You know, in sub-Saharan and immediate Saharan Africa, you get extraordinarily isolated populations where, again, the kind of slavery that's passed down from generation to generation really becomes a relationship of dependence. It's this sort of caste-based system, but also a system wherein those that are on the bottom, those that are the slaves, rely on masters for food, for raiment, for all manner of subsistence. And if we are going to address this, yes, addressing corruption is critical. But denying the role of absolute withering poverty, of underdevelopment in slavery is like denying the role of gravity in rainfall. You have to fundamentally address this not only as a psychological thing, as Nola so eloquently stated, but you also have to address the underlying relationships of dependence and break those cycles.
Well, but a lot of this is contingent on the fact that there's a general acceptability in some of these areas, like we're talking about with Mali, isn't it?
Yeah, to a certain extent, yeah. That is, and change in Mali and change in Mauritania is slow to come. There are glimmers of hope here, whispers of abolition across the Sahara. There was a young woman who recently took her case before the regional African court. She was born a slave. She essentially sued her master in a regional African court, and remarkably, with the help of Anti-Slavery International, the oldest human rights organization in the world, she won. So this can be done, but it certainly helps to have international partners like Not For Sale that actually back these partners globally as well as locally.
You want to weigh in here, David Besson?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, Ben and I have come to the place where we believe that, you know, addressing rule of law is critical, cultural shifts, but fundamentally we need to shift the economic ground that makes people so vulnerable to be trafficked. So I think it's coming up with new models. You know, we started by building villages for trafficking victims in Thailand and Peru and Romania, and we still believe that's important work, but at the end of the day, it was creating new companies, new enterprises that would address the economic vulnerability as well as provide new channels for people to find their destinies.
Well,
once
Ben
free.
Skinner has a company.
Well, we have Not For Sale.
You're involved in it too.
Yeah, we've created 8 companies out of Not For Sale. You can go into Whole Foods today and buy our drink. It's called Rebel, R-E-B-B-L. And then it leads all the way up the sophistication of the investment model to what Ben's doing with Tao. And yes, we've invested in Tao as well.
Yeah, we can hear a little bit more about Tao, but let me get to some callers here who have been waiting to join us. Sadir is first. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is related to something that one of the panel members mentioned about the trafficking that goes on. There is a source that is probably in South Asia or in Africa. My question is, what if at all, is the United States government doing in terms of collaborating with some of the agencies in those countries that are trying to stem the source of these trafficking in women and children?
Yeah.
I'll take my question off the air.
All right, thank you for the question. You'll take your answer off the air. David Besson.
Yeah, you know, the United States government has set up an office, the Trafficking in Persons Office that Ben made mention to earlier, and there's an annual report, an annual grading on how countries are doing, and there's strong efforts led by Luda Baca, the ambassador of that office, to address prevention and aftercare, and it's done a good job, I believe. It's really created leverage in places where previously there was no pressure, and there are economic and aid implications to the way that countries are able to show progress or not.
Here's Manuel, who's joining us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Michael. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Go to a restaurant in Folsom, California, an Indian restaurant, and I did get to know some of the waiters there, and they told me that when we add the tip to the credit card slip, the owner never gives them that amount. He keeps it, and they're afraid to do anything because, you know, they don't have working papers, and I'd like to know what I can do to help them. What I've done in the past is I give them the tip in cash directly. I hide it and give it to them, and I still add a little tip on the credit card so that the owner will not think that there's something going on. And another thing the owner does, you know, if he sees that the waiter talks, spends a lot of time with the customer, he comes to listen, to find out what's going on. You know, for me, that's a form of slavery, and I'd like to know what I can do or what can be done to help people like that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you for that. And David, you're nodding your head here.
This was my experience in the Bay Area, Berkeley restaurant, Indian restaurant. Hundreds of young people, teenagers, brought from India into the United States to work at this restaurant first. And so if you have a suspicion or if you have evidence in Northern California, contact Not For Sales office. We have a great website where you can find out how to contact us. We'll address it with the local law enforcement individuals that are appropriate. But it is important as citizens to act on your suspicions and your assumptions in a way that's responsible. And there are groups like Not For Sale that are able to help you out and support you.
And we go to another caller, and that's you, Joan. Thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on forum.
Hi. To what extent do governments participate in causing slavery? I think, for example, in the United States, with Michael Nesbitt, the computer hacker, and I believe the FBI forced him to do hacking. There was a program on, I believe it was Phil Donahue about 20 years ago, where it showed that the people who did the illegal break and entry, the hacking, even the assassinations, murders, were very often forced into this by having committed some, sometimes not very serious crime, maybe possession of marijuana or whatever, illegal entry. And I work for the U.S. government worldwide. To what extent do governments own slaves?
Can you help us on that, Ben Skinner?
Sure. It's a complex question, and there's no one answer, of course. Country by country, there are different practices. In Eritrea, for example, the system of quote-unquote national service, in fact, involves requiring Eritrean citizens of a certain age to serve in the businesses, in the private businesses, in many cases, of the ruling elites. In Uzbekistan, there is a system during cotton harvest season, the children are pulled out of school, and again, it's under the auspices of national service required to pick cotton. Can't say no, not paid, but they're required to pick cotton. Now, that cotton winds up everywhere. As I was seeing when we were doing work, investigative work for Tau early on, it in many cases winds up in Bangladeshi factories and then winds up in the clothes you're wearing. So the governments may profit, but we're the ones feeding the system.
Can you talk for a moment about Tau? Because it is a private company.
It is, yeah. So Tao Investment Management, essentially for me, is what I've been looking for years as a scalable solution to the problem that I've seen now being worse than at any point in human history. There are more slaves now than ever. And that really, for me, requires a robust response. It requires more than governments. It requires corporations. So essentially what we do is we look across the globe. We look for theaters and industries where things like human trafficking, things like gross environmental degradation, things like terrible safety violations, labor unrest, et cetera, where those problems are endemic and the industries in question are at an inflection point. So we'd actually been looking at the Bangladeshi apparel sector for a while before Rana Plaza, for about a year before Rana Plaza. Our feeling was, hey, this is not only terrible for these workers who in many cases are losing their lives, frankly, in these deplorable conditions. In other cases, are held in some form of debt bondage. But it's ultimately bad for business. This is inefficient means of production. Adam Smith, the original describer of capitalism, said that slavery was the dearest form of all labors. Many people don't know, in addition to being a capitalist, he was also an abolitionist. He felt that slavery was enormously inefficient. We do too, and we see turnaround opportunities through investment.
And mentioning Bangladesh reminds me when that fire occurred and the story broke and about the inhumane and terrible oppressive conditions of labor. We did a program on it, which is in our archives. And John from Menlo Park writes, it's been suggested that Stockholm Syndrome may be a myth or at least unhelpful as a label. While people in bondage can indeed end up having positive interactions with their captors, this may be better understood as a normal and even healthy reaction to fear and danger, one that allows the captive to survive and avoid punishment and thus live to flee another day. Labeling it as a syndrome instead pathologizes it and in that sense makes captives victims again yet. And actually, I think... We had a call on that from Mill Valley. Carl, you were talking about Elizabeth Smart and the Stockholm Syndrome?
Yeah, she also contested and kind of comes under the category of blaming the victim instead of considering that everything that the kidnapped person is doing is based on fear. Oh, can I just add one other thing? I ran into something else over the weekend. High-profile case in the UK involving the Roma and child brides that were being sold for up to, I think, $270,000 based on their ability to steal, but the Roma are contesting it as a part of a tradition of the dowry. So there's a cultural connection. Any comments?
Yeah. David Benson?
Well, we do work very closely in Romania with Roma communities in our shelter there and also our intervention work. And I just, there's the exploitation of people's freedom that we just feel needs to transcend. Well, these are our cultural traditions. And so things are done in the name of cultural tradition that take away the futures of young girls and boys in not only the Roma communities, but other communities. And we just feel we need to categorically say that's not acceptable.
Nola Brantley, what do you think about the whole idea of a Stockholm syndrome from your experience?
Well, I think what this gentleman described is exactly what Stockholm Syndrome is. And so I think that it's important that we have things that are already on the books, that are already recognized as psychological conditions that people suffer based on being captive and being traumatized, that we can associate with these victims. And I think it's exactly what he described, that they are smart enough to align themselves with their perpetrators in order to stay alive. But that's what Stockholm Syndrome is.
And I've got a listener named TJ who writes, listening to Michael say that internationally government collusion and slavery is a problem reminded me that we need to look more closely at the United States. For example, I believe it was in Pennsylvania that a year or so ago a judge was convicted of using his bench to impose sentences on juveniles in order to put them in work release programs whose executives were paying him kickbacks for doing so. Indeed, that was a shocking case. How much that goes on, though? Here's a consumer question from Chris on Twitter. Do you guys recommend investors and consumers pushing for divesting or boycotting companies outsourcing to high slavery nations, or does that compound the problem by further aggravating economic conditions there?
Well, we believe that instead of boycott, we should do boycotts. That we are participating with companies that are doing the right thing in their supply chain, and not only in the way that they create the right kind of protocols. So here in the Bay Area, we have a great technology company called Juniper Networks. And they've been working throughout their supply chain to make sure that everywhere they work in their electronics, that people's lives are enhanced. So we should, you know, we should buy products from companies that are doing well rather than looking for those that are doing bad.
And George asks, what influence do sanctuary laws have on human trafficking here in the United States? Do sanctuary laws encourage or discourage human trafficking?
Well, you know, I don't think the sanctuary laws are kind of significant enough to actually have a big impact, to be honest. I think the key thing in the San Francisco Bay Area is that it's our disregard for the fact that it's happening in our own backyard, and we're not doing enough about it. And I think we need to really put a scope on our own backyard, clean up our relationship to the international slave trade, and move from there.
Talk about our own backyard. I know you've been doing a lot of research, David, so you might want to respond to a listener who asks about how common human trafficking is in Bay Area nail salons and remarks that a few times I've noticed an extreme subservient attitude in salon workers and couldn't help but suspect that the women were being trafficked. And what behavior should we look for in workers, and who should we contact when we suspect something?
Well, you know, definitely within the service industries that she addresses, that's a high risk area. And so we have some great groups. Missy and Not For Sale are here locally. That's where our headquarters are. And if you've got suspicions, check it out with us. And if, you know, we do a first read, then we'll contact the appropriate authorities, either police or prosecution.
Here's a caller from Oakland. Mark, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Michael. Thank you for your program. And I appreciate the opportunity. With regard to the sheer economics that have been pointed to many times, I personally try and buy from companies that don't engage or support those that don't engage in slave trade with their products being manufactured. One of the things I want to caution your guest is that he, and I'll paraphrase, compared the money being spent on fighting slave trade versus fighting drug trafficking. And it all boils down to the ROI. And the reality is that I feel it's not fair, and many callers or many guests do it. Is
I'm sorry, Mark, what is ROI?
Return on investment.
The return on investment.
Oh, okay.
And so since it boils down to money, I mean, you can't just say, well, one is being spent more on one than the other without saying, gee, what are the effects of that, those dollars being spent to fight something? And in the case of drug trafficking, yeah, they may spend more, but is it a better spend? I mean, dollar for dollar, are less people being killed on the street through gang-related and other things that drugs do to people and lifestyle, et cetera, by fighting drug trafficking versus human trafficking? And so without the other end of the equation, it doesn't help your cause to make a comment like that unless you have the other half of the equation. So I would caution the guest to have both sides of the equation so we can see that, oh, okay, yes, it's a better spend to fight more drug trafficking or fight more human trafficking than it is to fight more drug trafficking.
Well, Mark, thanks for those comments. I think, Ben Skinner, you were the one that mentioned that. You want to respond?
Sure. I think you only have to look at national drug rate, national rate of drug use over the last 30 years as the drug war budget has increased to determine the true ROI on that investment. I was using those two statistics as a point of comparison. I'm not actually advocating for drug legalization with that. What I'm saying is if budgets reflect priorities, and if budgets are actually moral documents, as I think they are, and as I think many in Congress, despite recent inaction, agree, which is a more monstrous crime? Is it a 15-year-old smoking pot on the street corner who should be busted for possession, or is it a 15-year-old being sold for rape and, in many cases, destruction on the street corner? I think these are actually legitimate moral questions that reflect themselves in budget priorities.
And I thank Mark for his call, and I'm going right to another caller. Laurel, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, and I just caught the last part of your show, so I don't know if you've covered this yet, but I'm calling from Rainforest Action Network. We are working hard to expose the issues of child labor and forced labor in the palm oil industry in Indonesia and Malaysia, and something that, you know, people have known. The environmental consequences are extreme for a long while, but it's becoming more and more clear that you know, it's widespread throughout palm oil plantations that these are occurring. You know, young children are being duped into, you know, being held captive and working under horrendous conditions, and adults as well. And this is stuff that's being found in, you know, half of packaged goods in grocery stores. So connected to Americans, you know, every single day.
Yeah, I think, Ben Skinner, did you go undercover in that industry?
Yeah, I investigated it. I didn't go undercover. Rules of the game with Bloomberg Businessweek. You can't report on stuff you get undercover. But I actually went out, as I know Rainforest Action Network has in separate areas, to plantations in the middle of Borneo, and talked to workers who were some of whom were as young as 12 years old and literally enslaved in these far out palm oil plantations, locked in at night, beaten regularly, not paid anything for 2 years, and then paid, you know, fractions of cents per dollar. And you know, here we're talking about sheer violence, captive labor, and a product that winds up absolutely everywhere, although most of us don't know it. If you brush your teeth this morning, probably you used a toothpaste with sodium lauryl sulfate. That probably has palm oil in it. And palm oil, we know from the work that I've done, from the work that Rainforest Action Network has done, from the work that other groups have done, is infected with not only gross environmental violations, but slave labor.
Well, I think with just seconds left here, we've got to talk about what can be done. We've certainly touched on some, I think, good ideas as far as consumers and so forth. But when we're talking about slavery exploitation as opposed to servitude and all these kinds of things, you know, ordinary citizen looks at this and can feel somewhat overwhelmed, David Blanstone.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of it's a double-edged sword. It's you know, I don't do anything about it because it's invisible to me. And then, wow, I know so much, I feel paralyzed. So it both exactly. leads to inaction. But I tell you, if you're living in the Bay Area, Not For Sale is going to take the lessons it's learned around the world working, you know, in India and Thailand and Peru and Romania. And we're bringing it home to the Bay Area. So we're starting an invention hub that will engage corporations and nonprofits like NOLA's excellent group, Missy, and Catholic Charities. We're bringing an invention hub to the Bay Area, to San Francisco, and it's going to create new solutions for here backyard.
Keep on doing what you're doing, and thank you for the work you do. Nick Grono with us earlier from the Walk Free Foundation, CEO. We thank him. David Bastone, again, as president of the Not For Sale campaign. Benjamin Skinner, author of A Crime So Monstrous, Face to Face with Modern Day Slavery, and Nola Brantley, executive director and co-founder of Missy. Thank you all for being a part of this morning's program. Thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. And another hour ahead with David Strathairn. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.